I'm very happy now to welcome Michel Barsoum. He is a professor of material science and engineering at Drexel University. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you have been doing research on the construction of the Great Pyramids in Egypt. How did you decide to take on this subject?
Well, it's when I usually give my talk, the first thing I say is this is not my day job. And it's not, but I was minding my own business about 8 years ago, and I got a call from a friend of a colleague who said, "You're originally from Egypt, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "You're familiar with the mystery of the pyramids?" And I said, "Yes." Excuse me. And so then he rattled on, you know, a couple of facts that were that some of which I knew, some of which I didn't. Like, for example, there's no trace of any ramp. Some of the blocks are so close together you can't put a playing card between them, a few along those lines. And then he said, "But you know, the mystery was solved." And I said, "Oh yeah, I haven't heard." And he said, "Yeah, the pyramids are cast." So I laughed, and he said, "Why are you laughing?" I said, "What do you mean cast?" He says, "What, it's reconstituted limestone, it's like concrete." So I laughed harder. He said, "Why are you laughing?" And I said, "Well, I mean, this is the 21st century, right? With natural stone and artificial stone, on a scanning electron microscope, it should take me, what, maybe an hour and a half to you know, sort this out." And that's when he said, "Well, that's why I'm calling you." And this was 8 years ago, so obviously it took a little more than 2 hours. But that's how I got into it.
So he said to you, "The pyramids are not made out of stone. They're made out of essentially poured concrete."
Essentially a limestone-based, where the aggregate is limestone. So they look like limestone. They smell like limestone. And or I should say they look and smell like natural limestone, but they're not natural limestone.
So let's talk for a moment before we get into your research about some of the mysteries that he was saying that you just alluded to. The pyramids are very, very big, and so theoretical past theories of how they were constructed basically involves moving huge carved blocks via a ramp up the pyramids. I mean, explain how that scenario would work if it were true.
Okay, let me get a little bit, slightly more detail. So, and this guy said, so the guy who called me said, "Well, you know, I didn't solve the mystery, or I didn't come up with this idea. This guy, Joseph Davidovits in France, came up with this idea, and he's been maintaining it for the last 20 or so years. And in Joseph's scenario, the entirety of the pyramid is cast, and basically that gets rid of all ramps, and you don't have to worry about ramps because it's basically you form a human chain and you just cast the blocks in situ, okay? Basically, where you want the block, you cast the block. So that was the idea when I started. But looking at the stone and looking at a few other things, I'm now, first of all, there is not, to make this limestone concrete, you need lime. And lime you make by burning limestone at 900 degrees C or so. And burning limestone at 900 degrees C requires a lot of wood. And Egypt is not particularly known for having a lot of wood. And therefore, one of the criticisms, the fair criticisms over the years against Davidovits' theory was and is, there's not enough, you know, not enough trees in Africa, and I exaggerate a little bit, you know, to create all this lime to cast all this, all these blocks. And so Davidovits, to counter that, he came back and they said, okay, the Egyptians used ash, plant ash, you know, from cooking. And but we've disproved that categorically because plant ash has sodium and aluminum. And in none of the blocks we've ever looked at did we find any sodium or aluminum in the binding phase. So that idea is incorrect, which brings us back to how much wood did they have. So to make a long story short, what I believe is happening now, and this is work that I've been doing with over the last year or so with a Norwegian architect named Ole Brin, and his version of how the pyramids were built is actually pretty clever and pretty simple. You start with all pyramids are essentially step pyramids. Okay, so you build a step pyramid, and you have a ramp that goes from, you know, from the first step to the second step, from the second step to the third step. And like he Ollie likes to say, nobody's ever questioned how you make a step pyramid. That's pretty obvious. It's pretty simple. And as proof, you know, step pyramids exist all over the world, from Mexico to China to Japan, I think, and even the Canary Islands. So making a step pyramid is not very hard. What is difficult, extremely difficult, is to make a true pyramid. By that I mean where the four planes meet at the point. And that is very, very difficult, because if you're not exactly precise, those four planes that you build are not going to meet to the point, and you're going to get a hugely distorted structure unless you know what you're doing. So going back to how they built the pyramids, in my view, most of the pyramid, maybe 90% of it, is actually carved, and the old ideas hold. The only thing different is that making the step core does not require a huge, big, you know, a mile and a half ramp. All you do is you have a ramp. And then the clever thing about what Ole's idea came in as well is the fact that now if you have those internal ramps, the ramps that are going from one layer to the other, you just bury them in there. And so according to him, the ramps are inside the pyramid. Okay, and they're basically, because what goes up you don't want to take down again because the volume is so large anyway. So that's where my ideas have evolved, if you will. So to summarize, you have a step pyramid that you build, and then you encase it, and some of that stuff that you encase it with is the cast material. The other problem that the casting solves, okay, that has to this day not been solved by Egyptologists, is how do you make the top of the pyramid. The only way to make the top of the pyramid is either cast it or you need a mile and a half ramp into the desert. Well, there's no evidence for any ramp at all, let alone a mile and a half. And a mile and a half ramp, it would be the same size roughly as the pyramid, maybe even larger depending on some approximations you make. So the total lack of that evidence is a problem for Egyptologists.
We're talking to Professor Michel Barsoum about the mystery of the Great Pyramids. So you then went to Egypt and you were able to do some electron microscope testing on some samples of blocks. I imagine that wasn't so easy. I mean, I wouldn't think that they just want to give samples of the pyramids to people
easily. Well, let me, the paper that we published in 2006, I got all my samples. Most of my samples I got from Joseph Davidovits, and I got one sample from Professor de Mortier in Belgium, and that's what made the basis of the 2006 paper that came out. Now, you're right, and that is probably the most frustrating part of this project is samples, and it's not easy to get them. But they're around, and they are obtainable, but again, they're not official.
So what did you find when you did your testing?
All right, well, in 2006, the paper that basically, the work that culminated in the 2006 paper was we looked at stones from the pyramids and stones from the surroundings of the pyramids, essentially from the quarries of the pyramids. And we convinced ourselves that we saw some chemistries and some shapes and some what we call microstructures in the pyramid samples that, A, were not in the natural samples, but more importantly, some of these phases or regions did not exist in sedimentary rocks. As you may know, sedimentary rock, or limestone is a sedimentary rock. So we found things in there that really don't belong in sedimentary rocks, okay? And so that was the strength of that paper. And we said, well, you know what? This is interesting, okay? It could still be natural. I mean, we haven't done an exhaustive, you know, catalog of every limestone in the world, but we had the control samples from the surroundings of the pyramids, and that's what we used as a control. And so that was in 2006. Now, in the intervening years, last year I had a student who did his master's degree trying. So we know the so Davidovits has claimed that you have the plant ash and you make the stuff. What we find is that the ingredients, what we believe the ingredients the Egyptians used were actually simpler than that. They were lime. You still need lime. And diatomaceous earth. Diatomaceous earth is a form, it's a mineral that's made of basically silicon dioxide, which is sand, but it's not the quartz that you find, it's not the sand that you put in mortars, but actually a very, very delicate microorganism that lives in the ocean called diatoms. And when they die, they rain down on the bottom of the ocean and they form these layers that today we mine. And you know, diatomaceous earth is used in many things. Among them, pool filters and as an additive to some foods, etc. So it's a, you know, it's a mineral. So the Egyptians used that mineral that exists 70 kilometers south of Giza. I checked that. And then they did put lime, water, and then they added the limestone rubble, okay, what civil engineers would call the aggregate, okay? So the aggregate, so 90%, if you will, of the stone is aggregate, which looks like limestone. And then the cementing phase is essentially a calcium silicate. It has calcium and it has silicon and it has oxygen. Now, to convince a geologist that finding calcium and silicon and oxygen in limestone is proof that it is synthetic has been and remains a challenge because, you know, they've seen nature is extremely resourceful in all kinds of things. One of the difficulties in this project was indeed all the different things that we find in the natural limestone that, you know, just were amazing. But that's nature. Anyway, to make a long story short, so I had this student who just finished his master's in June. And so what he did is he added diatomaceous earth, lime, limestone, and water. And sure enough, he got some, you know, good-looking limestone, all right? So then looking at that, we realized something very important, which is there are two cementing reactions going on simultaneously. One is the formation of this calcium-silicon hydrate, which is the same one, by the way, that occurs in Portland cement, okay, that we use every day. But there was another interesting reaction, hardening reaction, that's the recarbonation of the lime. What does that mean? When you take limestone and you heat it up, you lose CO2 and you end up with lime, which is calcium oxide. If you leave lime in the air, it reabsorbs the carbon dioxide and goes back to limestone. So you can imagine how difficult it is to prove that, you know, one limestone is a natural aggregate and the other one is not. Luckily, then in November, about a year ago, it hit me that if indeed we have recarbonated lime, then we should be able to carbon date the pyramid samples. And so I sent these samples to a lab in Florida called Beta Analytics, and they came back, sure enough, all the pyramid samples we sent them had carbon-14 in them, and all the natural limestone samples we sent them did not. Now, this is extremely important because carbon-14, well, carbon dating depends on measuring carbon-14, which a tree or a human being absorbs from the atmosphere. But after a while, that carbon-14 decays, and that while is about 50,000 years. So if anything is older than 50,000 years, chances of it having carbon-14 are zero. Now, given that the natural limestone is, according to geologists, 50 million years old, then the chances of having carbon-14 in a 50-million-year-old limestone is exactly zero. So when we find this carbon-14, it really boosted this idea of ours, and the paper has gotten accepted in a journal called Radiocarbon and should appear in a month or two.
One of the things that you've discovered through the research and publication that you've been doing is that there's a lot of pushback from Egyptologists who don't want to accept the idea that the pyramids are anything but carved. The idea that they should be cast, or even the word concrete or anything like that, is just anathema to them. And you've had to deal with, I think you called it in one of your papers, political science lessons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the lecture that I sort of digress a little bit. Yes, and again, the reasons for that are varied, and the reasons, some of them are very understandable. Probably the easiest one to convey is Zahi Hawass, which is executive secretary of the Antiquities Department in Egypt. He calls pyramidiocy. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pyramidiocy out there. Some people claim that the Great Pyramid was a giant battery. Some other people claim that it was a nuclear reactor. And, of course, Van Deneken started this all with chariots of the gods. I mean, talk about extraterrestrials and the like. So the pyramid, the Great Pyramid especially, is shall we say, full of these ideas, and the vast majority of them are, you know, are bunk. So that's one reason you see that. The other one is when you look at the pyramids, and I think it's obvious that some of those blocks are absolutely not carved. And as a matter of fact, half my talk is showing people pictures, just simple pictures, and asking them whether they thought something was cast or carved. The difference is not that difficult. Okay? The human eye can immediately tell the difference between a stone wall in Ireland, you know, and a cast concrete floor in, I don't know, anywhere in the world. It's not that hard. And so when Davidovits came out, and he to this day is insistent that the entire thing is cast, and when people look at it and they say, wait a minute, this does not look cast, that, I think, was also a sort of a nail in the coffin on the sarcophagus. So there are these issues. The other one that's problematic is also Davidovits claims that if you take the limestone from the Giza Plateau and you put it in water, it actually disaggregates and falls apart because there's so much clay in it. Now, I grew up literally in the shadow of the pyramids, and I've been on the Giza Plateau innumerable times, and I can tell you that 90% of the limestone on the Giza Plateau is limestone. And if you put limestone in water, it does not disaggregate. So I think part of the problem was the initial, there's another factor, I think, which is very important. To this day, Davidovits claims that the cementing phase is sodium aluminum silicate. Well, people who looked at these samples never found, and we never found, sodium or aluminum, and therefore, you know, that certainly weakens your case. So I think, and then I think there's a vested interest in keeping the mystery alive, in the sense that, you know, and again, mysteries are good for the soul. And don't get me wrong. Three times I was going to quit this project because it didn't sit right with me that I was going to be the person to demystify the pyramids. And three times I was talked back into keep doing it, and I'm glad I did.
Well, that's what scientists do, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we search for the truth. And it's been an amazing ride, and, you know, and I could still be wrong. I mean, this is the part that I concede. At the end of my talk, I could still be wrong. Okay, it's possible that, you know, you have some limestones in nature that show all the things that we found, and it's possible that you have enough contamination in natural limestone that you have carbon-14. Now, you know, I can go into the details if you're interested as to why I don't think what we saw is contamination, but I'll let the scientists decide, and that's how the science, you know, works. Is you have a couple of hypotheses, and then, you know, one of them gets stronger by evidence. The other one falls by the wayside, and we make progress. And I think this is going to be the very same way. I mean, you know, if in 2 years somebody comes up and he says we carbon dated some natural limestones from the vicinity of the pyramids, and there's tons of carbon 14 in them, and, you know, Barsoom is all wrong, so be it. I mean, okay, I made the conclusion I made with information I had at the time, and that's where, you know, that's where it led me. Now, again, I could be wrong.
What research remains to be done to demonstrate your hypothesis?
I think it's actually very, very simple. The problem with the samples I have on the carbon dating is they all come from the surface, okay, by default, okay? Well, all we need is one core sample, okay? You need to drill through, all right? You go from the surface to the inside, and you get a core of one block that you think is cast. And then you carbon date the inside of the core and the outside of the core. And if the carbon 14 is the same inside as it is outside, then it cannot be contamination. If there's a gradient, if you have more carbon 14 on the outside and zero in the inside, presumably that's a 50 million year old limestone, so the only carbon 14 that you can ever get has to be on the surface, that's it. You know, game, set, and match, it's over. Because carbon-14, as opposed to microstructure and opposed to everything else, is extremely objective. You cannot make it, you cannot fake it. I mean, it's carbon-14, okay, and it's there. I mean, carbon dating is an extremely established, again, as you probably know, is a Cadillac of tests. I mean, if you have carbon-14, you have carbon-14. End of story.
One of the things that's interesting about this is if this is true and that parts of the pyramids were cast, it's a concrete like nothing that we have ever been able to make ourselves. It lasts just nearly infinitely longer than anything that our modern technology has produced.
That's absolutely, I mean, that to me is what is just unbelievable. I mean, if it is indeed concrete, it's lasted 4,500 years. Our Portland cement, if it lasts 200 years, is really top-notch. I mean, most sidewalks, as you know, deteriorate after 50 years or less. And the stuff is just unbelievable. You hit it right on the nail. I mean, that's just, if we can reconstitute that, if we can learn how to do this, it's pretty, first of all, it would be very useful. The other thing that I need to point out, which is, I think, very important, and one of the reasons I kept going with this project, is the fact that, you know, how energy intensive and how complicated or complex can a 4,500-year technology be? And the answer to both questions is not very. Okay? So what that means is if I figure out how to make this recipe, literally, every farmer in Africa, every, you know, farmer in India, okay, in Haiti, all right, can mix up this goop and make a beautiful house that looks like limestone, that doesn't look like concrete, that is durable, that will last for a very long time. That really has been and remains my main motivation to do this, because I think we can do it. I mean, again, if it's true and it's been done 4,500 years ago, then we should be able to do it. The reason at this point, so based on this work that my student did for his master's, there is one problem with that concrete, the Egyptian concrete, and that is it's slow to set. Now, so, you know, will we be using that concrete in downtown Philadelphia anytime soon? And the answer is not, unless we can figure out how to speed up the reaction and the cementing reaction very, you know, dramatically, which is possible. Now, but if you are a farmer in Africa, or again, or in India, or wherever you are, that is not that big of a concern, especially if you're only going to build a one-story or maximum a two-story building. Because today they use mud bricks, and the stuff that we make is certainly stronger than mud bricks.
And so then you're talking about building houses that could in theory, last for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, if you take it... Now, one has to be slightly careful because, you know, one of the reasons the pyramids have been so durable is the size, like you mentioned at the very beginning, the size. I mean, you know, you have to go... I mean, I don't know if you've ever been, but, I mean, some of these blocks are like 50 tons. I mean, they look like a school bus. I mean, not all of them, but some of them. And so it was built on a scale that is hard to just, you know, wrap your arms around. But having said that, some of these outer casing blocks that I've seen in Egypt, they look as pristine today and at the very outer surface, which presumably should weather, they are as, you know, they look brand new. I mean, they look like, you know, they're not pockmarked. I mean, they look superb. So, yeah, there is hope.
Has this been picked up by the media? I mean, if there's one thing that the public loves, it's stories about the Egyptians, about the pyramids, and so on. I'm surprised, not that I watch these channels, but I'm surprised I haven't seen it on cable or something, your story. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, when the 2006 paper came out, you know, there was some, you know, New York Times ran an article, and there was a little bit of a buzz. But then, you know, it sort of quickly died down. And I think part of the problem was that maybe the 2006 paper, you know, was not necessarily, you know, the so-called smoking gun. Maybe the Carbon 14 paper, when it gets published, will create another buzz. But I mean, you know, I've been talking to people on and off, and Discovery Channel's called, and you know. But things, I guess, has remained under the radar.
Michel Barsoum is a professor of materials science and engineering at Drexel University. Professor Barsoum, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.